Sex, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the speculative interdimensional vehicle, Sex in Space. Its mission, to explore new points of view, to seek out fresh opinions, to boldly go where so many have gone before, and still somehow manage to totally miss the point. Subscribe to Sex in Space, wherever quality podcasts are found.
Hi there, and welcome back to Sex in Space. I'm Toshi, and we're delighted to have you join us today for another podcast episode. Wherever you're tuning in from, thanks for being with us. Please don't forget to leave a like, comment, or review. Your feedback and support means the world to us. If you want to check out some more great Sex in Space content, head on over to our YouTube channel, which has video versions of our podcast episodes if you'd rather watch and listen at the same time. You can search for us using our handle at sexinspace.com, and you can also find us on Instagram and TikTok under that handle too. For today's episode, Jane had the privilege of speaking with Nikki Denham, and I'm going to let Jane do the introduction today. So let's get into it.
Today, we are here with Nikki Denham, who is has an MNZM, deservedly so, an NZ Order of Merit for those that are acronym challenged. And Nikki has got an extraordinary background. We could have talked across a really wide range of subjects today that we're going to focus on one, a background in health, and has been a pioneer who's specialized in establishing and leading positive, community-driven and solution-focused projects in response to emerging sexual health and gender issues. Amongst other things, Nikki's a company director of Exposure International, which is wildly creative and just worth Googling to have a look at the work. Incredible. A collective of storytellers who want to bridge the gap between story and those who need to hear it. And project director of the FGM education program, Female Genital Mutilation, subject dear to my heart, having been involved with refugees as survivors many years ago. And director of the Light Project, which is how we found Nikki, and how she comes to be here with us today. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. As I said, we could talk to you about lots of things, but we're here to talk about the Light Project. And so for the benefit of our listeners, can you explain what the Light Project is and how it came to be?
Yes, of course. So the Light Project is essentially a response, a service that's a response to the changing online sexual landscape for young people in Aotearoa. So we set it up maybe 5-6 years ago. I was doing a lot of work in the child sex trafficking space and actually spent a lot of time up in the Philippines, which is the international hub for the cyber sex industry, and was quite surprised at how many girls we met who had been rescued from trafficking that were involved in online pornography industry. So I'm like from the Playboy generation, and thought, came back to New Zealand and thought, oh gosh, I need to learn a little bit more about porn as it is now. So did some research and essentially was kind of mindful that we've got this whole new landscape for our rangatahi, for our young people, in terms of what, how much porn is out there, how readily it's accessed, and how it's really shifting and shaping youth sex culture in quite new and diverse ways. So we've got that on one hand, and then we've got a real silence from adults, or if anything, a reticence to engage in any kind of sex positive conversation, a lot of shaming around porn. So yeah, really felt like for our young people, there's this massive gap. They're kind of navigating this world on their own. So we set up the Light Project essentially to train and work with adults just as much as young people, just to help offer some tools and strategies to have kind of positive conversations and help them navigate the online world.
I mean, from that beginning, it's a pretty amazing project. It's very comprehensive and there's a lot of resources on offer there. What sort of response have you had?
We've actually had a really, really positive response. Young people love it because finally people are talking about porn. So we've had fantastic response from young people, and a lot of our resources, like our youth site in the Know, was really birthed out of young people telling us what they wanted information on, what the trends were, what they were curious about, what they were struggling with. So that's been met really well. And then in terms of the adult workforce, again, most adults that work with young people, particularly in a health or a sexual violence capacity, are seeing the way in which porn potentially can shift and shape young people's understandings around sex and particularly sexual violence. So again, they've really welcomed the opportunity to grow and learn and I just guess get some tools and strategies when working with young people.
So the site itself, although it came out of Aotearoa, it feels totally able to be useful for an international audience, in English speaking at least. I don't know if there are translations, but it feels very globally accessible. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that, and we've actually had a lot of interest internationally in the site. Countries like America, Australia use particularly the videos that young people, you know, where young people talk about their experiences. And I think it's a really safe place for young people that use porn, are struggling with porn, to go and get some really helpful information. So I think there's a universal gap in terms of having safe conversations around porn and offering young people information. So potentially our site, you know, is quite helpful with that for now until we get more material through.
I was just listening to a TED Talk this morning on the importance of signposting valuable information in order to realize its impact. And so I guess anybody out there listening to this, you know, get on, have a look, but share what the Light Project are doing, because putting it out there, you know, it may not be what you need right now. It might be, but it might be what somebody else needs. And I think that really came home to me. A chance conversation between two neighbors having a huge impact and outcome in this particular presentation. And it's that kind of sharing that information and disseminating out through community networks that can make a real difference. This is extraordinary work. Like, you're clearly, you know, it's a lifetime commitment to a cause of sexuality education. How did you get here?
Yeah, it's interesting because I never have and still don't think of myself as a sex educator. I think, my work has probably been emerging sexual health issues and trends like female genital mutilation. Obviously, I do a lot of work in the sex trafficking space. I was very involved with HIV/AIDS in the early days, and maybe is this a bit macabre, but attracted to or interested or feel challenged by issues that people don't want to talk about. And particularly with the porn one, I don't see porn as a youth problem or a youth issue. I think it's really an adult issue. As adults, we have created the porn industry. And when we talk about porn now, it's quite a narrow term. It's really just online sexual content.
Yeah.
You know, as many young people access porn through other platforms than they do through porn sites. But, you know, I think they estimate around 500 and 1,000 new sites are being developed every week, or domain names are being used for porn. And so we've created this industry, and then we've given young people the devices, and then we've said, you know, don't talk to us, or if you do, we'll judge you or shame you. So I guess in terms of this particular project, I felt quite strongly. I had three full-time, two part-time teenagers in our home during the early days of this work, and I'm like, no one's talking about this, and it's completely changing online sexual content, young people's sexual vernaculars. They don't see themselves as having an offline and online sexual world. They're just woven together, and yet as adults, we're just not helping them navigate it. And I think that's a quite a frightening or concerning thing that we, you know, we're not engaging with young people, which is, you know, when I read your recent book for parents, I'm like, this is so, so important and so good because, you know, this is what should be happening.
Yeah, it's, I think, breaking that cycle of gap. You know, we grew up, I mean, like your Playboy generation, you know, we grew up and what we discovered for ourselves. One of my team was saying the other day, who's of a vintage also, you know, when magazines were it, but dictionaries were the place you went to try and understand what was what, because that was the only place that you could get definition. So things have changed. There's certainly a lot more around in terms of content available, but it's now partly signposting, which is what I was talking about before, directing people to you. What's good and what's bad, you know, which is like very judgy, but you have to try and be able to understand those differences. So even whilst breaking a gap, we're needing to accelerate that education again, because, you know, there's a lot of fake news, to quote a terrible person, in the sexuality space.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're spending a lot of time at the moment, for example, looking at resiliency factors and protective factors for young people. So when they're online, they're engaging with sexual content, what are the factors that mean that their risk is amplified in terms of it negatively impacting them and shifting and shaping their sexual understandings and behaviours, and what's protective? And interestingly, in terms of protective factors, most of them do require some form of adult engagement. They're about role modeling healthy sexual relationships, about good and robust relationships and sexuality education. They're about critical thinking, like you said, so they when they're watching content, they're knowing, okay, this in real life, this is not okay. This, you know, could be racist, sexist, misogynistic in terms of how I express myself sexually. So, but a lot of that, it does require that signposting. It requires passing on information, building agency and critical thinking in young people. Mm. And when we don't have those conversations, it's you know, it potentially really means the risk is greater, if that makes sense.
It does. And the problem is we're not having basic educational conversations, let alone
about porn. Talk about sex, let alone porn.
Yeah, it feels like that's another step, huh?
Yeah, but in many ways, I guess my sense is the horse is bolted. If we're not having those conversations, then young people are going online. We know that, you know, the New Zealand data of our regular youth users, 73% use porn to learn about sex. 1 in 5 have tried something they've seen in porn. So it's kind of already happening. You know, and the other thing we often talk about is that when we don't have those conversations with young people around, let's say, online sexual content, we're actually still giving young people a message, and that message is we don't talk about porn. Isn't it? You know, we're actually saying in our silence, we're saying to young people, adults, don't talk to you about porn. And what that does, it means they've got to navigate what they see online on their own. They're not having those opportunities to build critical thinking or counter message some of the more violent messages in porn. And it's a real barrier to help. If you know that you don't talk to adults about porn, you know, the shame is really great in terms of actually having to go to an adult and say they're struggling or something like that. So, you know, it's problem that our silence is problematic in a rapidly changing online world for, you know, really most of the Gen Zs and Gen Alphas.
I agree. I think I like the way you're raising the complexity of it all too. These subjects are woven into each other. There's been such a shift towards increased aggression in porn over the 10, 15 years I've been involved with researching it. And it's echoed by some of the major challenges we see playing out socially with gender-based violence, certainly sexuality-based violence. It's not all gender-based, but the kind of thematics of porn are definitely aggressive. And so I think for young women, particularly, that are coming into this space, what's the advice that comes through in the work that you do on how to manage if they are in a situation where sex is starting to play out like a porn script and the ask is of violence or choking is the popular one? Do you have resources that are specific for people to deal with that?
Yeah, we actually do. The rough sex and choking one is a really interesting thing. In the last 2 to 3 years, and I know you'll know this from, you know, all the I know you spent a lot of time looking at porn sites, as have we, which is, yeah, interesting way to start your day, but that's what we do, and important. And yeah, the data now is very compelling in terms of how pervasive sexual aggression is across porn. And I think what's interesting is when porn sat with a kind of an immoral framework, you know, in the days of Playboy, yep. which you hardly even think of as porn anymore. It's so PG. But in those days, kind of everyone thought the harms were just pretty much, apart from some of the kind of objectification of women, were around addiction. But what we see now is a really diverse and almost more systemic change in terms of harm with the way in which porn is shifting and shaping what young people understand to be sexual violence, potentially their expectations, laying sexual scripts, and then their experiences of sexual violence. So in terms of what we call these diverse sexual behaviours, rough sex, choking, we're seeing probably the word I would use from our work with widespread work we do with stakeholders, a significant escalation in those behaviours where they're becoming really quite normative. And that's a problem for young women and for the young men and our young queer people in terms of what they think is normative, and then just what can be really tricky in the play out of them in terms of relationships. So in terms of advice or information, it's a really much bigger conversation here around what we're seeing in terms of normal and health. Is this normal? Is this healthy? So we use quite a strong ethic lens rather than it kind of being bad or good in terms of, you know, how do we feel about these behaviours in terms of some of the messaging behind them, that women enjoy, largely women enjoy violence, that aggression is okay, that domination, racism, transphobia, biphobia, homophobia, a lot of these themes we're seeing in pornography where you've got targets and recipients of aggression and the recipients, often women, look like they enjoy it. That messaging can be really tricky for young people to unpack. And for example, with the rise of rough sex and choking, a lot of the services that work with young people say to us things like, oh, we just keep telling young people that's not normal. But for many young people that grow up online, you know, right across media, like something like choking, a lot of young people learn from memes, not from porn sites. But it is normal for them. So it's having conversations around even taking away that binary language. But let's just place this within an ethical lens and how does it sit with our own views, ideas, culture, faith around, you know, pleasure, aggression. So it's almost like it's not real, because actually online it is really happening, and then young people try it out in real life, but it's looking at it and unpacking it from a kind of a much wider ethical lens. So in terms of your question on specific resources, when we noted a very high rise in rough sex and choking, we developed some content on our youth site specifically on rough sex and another one on choking. So we asked young people, what do you need to know?
Right.
And they, you know, they wanted to know things like, can you choke safely? Which you can never fully choke safely. But, you know, if they were curious about rough sex. How do we do that safely? What are the measures we put in place to mitigate risk? You know, care, consent, communication. Is this what we want? Does it sit with us? So it's resources that get young people to really understand risk, but also think critically about this, about the diverse and new ways they're expressing themselves sexually and whether that actually fits with their own kind of agency and sense of, you know, what's okay and what's not.
Yeah, it all comes back to basic sex education, huh? Understanding sexuality, understanding pleasure. And yet there's such a, not only is it not a conversation being had at home, there's a really interesting cultural pushback taking place now on sexuality education. This morning, I was reading in The Guardian, Kinsey Institute's under threat because of the way that funding, actually I'll get it right, the Republican-dominated state legislature voted to block the Kinsey Institute from receiving state funds through Indiana University. This was last April, but they're in limbo, and they—it's at this point they don't know how this is going to play out for them. But it's part of a wider conservative pushback on sex education. We've experienced it. You know, we can't get served up to anybody on Instagram who doesn't already follow us. It's an extraordinary kind of holding in of who we are and what we do because we talk about pleasure. We could talk about reproductive health. We can talk about all sorts of things, but sexual pleasure is where you start to get closed down. And in our world, it's happening in all channels. Is it something that you're experiencing in your world?
Not so much, because at the moment we've solely focused on workforce development for the services that are working with young people who are off. So that's our family violence, sexual violence professionals, youth health services, rainbow services. So we in many ways have quite a strong health lens, and our role is to actually provide information to those that provide sex ed, if that makes sense. But I do think there's some bigger issues there in terms of, I think, the way adults have kind of postured our conversation with young people around around sex and around things like pornography in terms of not being quite adult-centric and not kind of youth-led, participatory, building up youth agency around a lot of these things. And I think while it's really problematic if we, you know, if we end up not teaching this content in schools, it's also the responsibility of, you know, parents, aunties, us as a society to kind of normalize this conversation, because we feel quite hopeful for young people. We think given the right critical thinking around these issues, they will be able to navigate things well. You know, think of things like climate change with our Gen Zs and sexuality and gender diversity, getting a little bit better with racism. Young people are, you know, tapping into their own agency around a lot of these things and starting to build, you know, critical thinking and become a little bit more resilient. And so we feel the same can be done in the porn space. Like, for example, I was working with a, we work with an amazing Te Papa Māori org who are based up in, up north, and they were saying this week, even just Te Ao Māori concepts and young people trusting, you know, what is my puku, what does my gut tell me here, like how do I engage in a way online that aligns with values that don't diminish the mana of woman, and you know, so it's stuff that's actually already there, if that makes sense, that we just need to open up the conversation. And I think that's been one of the really damaging things, particularly, let's say, in the conservative churches around purity culture, in terms of taking away from young people their own agency and ability to trust themselves, you know, rather than this kind of posture that sex is bad and wrong and you're quite dangerous and you need to be careful about the clothes you wear. I just think it just isn't helpful. But if we can tell young people to trust themselves and give them skills to navigate what they're seeing, it applies to so many of the other harms we're seeing, like sex torsion, revenge porn, nudes being shared. We need to help young people build this kind of critical thinking and resiliency so they can make really healthy and good decisions for themselves and their future selves, if that makes sense.
It makes very good sense. And I guess the message is to the generation of parents that sort of sit in the middle, that aren't the Gen Zs and the alphas coming through, who have a different sensibility and an opportunity. But there's a lot in the millennial community who are parents now.
Yes.
And they are dealing with having children, raising children. And they didn't have that education unless they had you or I as mothers. and then they're over it. I guess the message is get educated. Yeah, start with you, yeah?
Yeah, I think the message is, first of all, don't be frightened. You know, I think over the course of history, there's always new things. I remember when the fax came in and we were like, whoa, and are we going to be getting, evil faxes sent from, there's always new things. And I think, if you look particularly at Indigenous cultures, there's so much just faith in their own knowing. And I think as parents, if we just go, right, this is just a whole new world online, we need to school up. When my kids were, were younger and teenagers, I'm like, we just got to get everything. Back then it was like Ask FM and TikTok, and we just need to school up on all of this stuff and then just work alongside our young people so we are a safe place, regardless of whatever their experiences are, and we can help, we can have open conversations to help them think critically. And we work with so many young people that used to watch porn and don't watch it anymore because they're like, it doesn't sit well with what I think about women and pleasure, and I don't want to click and support an industry that's pretty misogynistic and isn't for the benefit of young people and having better sex lives. So I think young people can grow and change and think critically. But we need to take some responsibility as adults.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, if you're in that framing that you offer, I think what millennials, if we look at that parental band, can relate to really well is they are they use technology. They're the first generation to come through living and breathing it. And their parents, they've had to help their parents get up to speed and still do with, just what that represents. And I guess, if you think about it in that way, it's like, imagine if you'd not grown up with technology and you were wandering into it now. Well, you haven't grown up with a sex education. You're wandering into it now. You reach out, get help. And not only don't be afraid, but understand that the risks are as great as your parents not understanding online fraud and having an online bank account,
Absolutely. That's such a good point.
So definitely getting educated, and also just understanding, I guess, the technologies of sexuality. That's the other thing we don't – it's in there. It's in what you've been talking about, but it's not necessarily well understood how we make sense of who we are and how to be in the world, how we become shaped. And we've talked about the potential shaping effects. But if we understand that we are not born fully formed and that we are shaped in and through these cultural texts, there's some very complicated conversations there around what shapes desire, what manifests as pleasurable, how we understand what that looks like, and the complexities then of how to navigate finding something pleasurable, but then being confronted with finding that there's conflict in that because it doesn't necessarily sit with that ethical framework. Sometimes you've got to navigate that.
I absolutely agree with that. And if you think, like, a lot of our work is kind of embedded in sexual script theory and in terms of, that we do become sexual beings, and what we see and what we observe, when we think about the risk of porn, I think this is really an important factor, like an eight-year-old that grows up watching porn every day, that isn't having conversations around porn, that has never had real-life sexual experience, that thinks porn is real, the potential for risk for them is far greater than a 19-year-old that watches it once a week, that, you know, is able to kind of think critically around it. So for some young people, in the absence of any information conversation, there is a potential that porn can have quite a significant impact on the way that they express themselves sexually and a lot of their views and ideas, particularly around sexual violence. So this is what the research is telling us around young people that watch a lot of sexual violence, that they are more likely to hold views, view women as women, to accept aggression towards women. They're more likely to perpetrate aggressive behaviours and not intervene in an act of aggression. So that is problematic, and that's something that I think we need to be mindful of. But for most young people that just might watch porn occasionally, this is where, as adults, we need to have these really open and safe conversations. So a big thing that we offer up to adults is exactly what you were saying, is the importance of normalizing arousal, and that for young people, when they see sexual content, even when they're tiny, they often will, you know, might feel really mixed things, you know, like grossed out, curious, disgusted, excited, and aroused. And we say it's really important to normalize all of those things. So if a young person sees porn and comes and tells an adult, to be able to say, you know what, you might have felt this or that or all of those things, and all of those are okay and totally normal. Yeah. And I think when we demystify the kind of arousal aspect, it's so helpful for young people. It takes out the shame, and it also helps them go, actually, I don't like what I see, but my body's responding positively to nude women, or nude men, and that's okay. But I'm going to make a choice now, you know, particularly as they go into their teen years, that because I know in terms of the potential harms of other things, and I don't want this to shift and shape what I think's kind of good and normal and healthy around sexual relationships, I'm not going to watch that. Whereas if we conflate, if they're aroused by it, they must like it, and then it's part of them, that's really tricky for a young person. And if they've got a parent that says porn is bad, where do they go with that? You know, this is bad. Yeah. I'm being aroused to it. I'm bad.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they'll probably go watch some more porn because there's all these lovely hormones when you watch it to escape that shame. So it's this, you know, which is what we're seeing in terms of problematic porn usage or addiction. We're seeing a higher rate amongst young people from faith-based communities, which is really largely related to the shame that this is bad. There's all these taboos around it. I am a bad person because I watch it. And then they may retreat back into porn to try and escape that feeling. So the shame and the not normalizing an arousal response can be really problematic for young people.
Yeah, and this is back to parents educating themselves. A shame response is coming from the parent. And, you know, non-judgmental parenting is such a gift.
Yeah.
So I guess if you feel anything like disgust or a response of bad to sexuality, sexual materials out there, education is such a great way to unpack that and to understand that you've been culturally shaped to understand these things in these ways. And in fact, arousal is normal, and there's nothing shameful about it. And that in and of itself can be life-changing for parents to understand of any gender or sexual orientation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, young people tell us things like, they say, even if there was kind of some stranger danger or something awful on the internet, talk to mum and dad, it's such a safe place. They said, even if you see a porn pop up, you're too frightened to tell your parent. You know, that you might be judged, you might be shamed. And then that's the other, you know, all the data in New Zealand, we did research with young people, we did a survey, and then there's a wonderful classification office research, And one of the biggest things young people said was they just felt uncomfortable around porn. And when you unpack that with young people, it's that on one hand, we know that the violence and the aggression is problematic and is not okay and doesn't sit well with us. But on the other hand, we're being aroused to it, which makes sense because it's new bodies. And it's the space of where do you go with that? Who do you tell that? You know, this tremendous tension and discomfort. And that's, again, where as adults we're not offering the space and the conversations young people need to help unpack that.
Yep. And I think that for anybody out there who this resonates for, get into the Light Project, climb in there, read what they've written, watch the videos, listen to young people, and educate yourself to be able to educate your young people, because we cannot rely on educational environments to do that. It's not, I mean, they too came through without sexuality education and they're faced with this classroom often of young people and not a toolkit to feel comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's not a, even with sex ed at schools, you know, how many times a year, you know, it's minimal. And I guess that's where I think we should just be normalizing them. It's these conversations weekly, monthly, you know, it's not a conversation. It should just be normalized across all the conversations we have with young people around what they're watching in media, critical thinking, relationships, just as a day-to-day part of it.
Absolutely. And you mentioned aunties before, you know, it's that broader community of mums, dads, aunties, uncles, grannies, granddads, you know, that we can all participate in supporting this and understand it as a bit of a revolution that can start at home.
Yeah, absolutely. And potentially should start at home, shouldn't it? Because that's the safest place, you know, and we often think about that, you know, when we do a bit of work with schools and talk to the fact that if you're going to be engaging and talking around porn, then really needs, the school needs to be aligned in terms of shame-free messaging and supporting young people who may actually identify that they've experienced harm. And that's the advantage with parents talking around this, is that often and hopefully it can be a safe place where they can be like, well, actually, I'm really struggling like with this, that, or the other, or I'm in a relationship where a partner's wanting to do stuff that they've seen in porn and I'm not comfortable with that, or certain behaviours have been normalised and I don't like that. Because within a school context, arguably they may not raise that with the school, you know, a sex ed teacher or whatever. So, you know, parents, families, you know, whānau is just such a great place, an important place to be having these conversations.
Completely. So with, I mean, you have so much on your plate already. I'm not sure about this next question, but what next for you?
Well, yeah, at the moment we're looking, we're working with both sexual harm services and sexual violence prevention services, and we're seeing quite a few gaps there. So, for example, some of the big gaps we're seeing are young people that have grown up watching a lot of aggressive porn, and further to our conversation in terms of us becoming sexual beings and our environmental influences, some young people are really struggling with finding themselves on a trajectory with searching and being aroused by very, very extreme porn, you know, rape porn, very, very violent porn. As you know, there's a lot of family sex, sibling sex and porn. And for them, it can be really tricky in terms of they may not meet the threshold of requiring or being seen at a sexual harm service. But where do they get information from? Where do they get help from? What do you do with that? So we're currently looking at that's quite a big gap. Also, just in terms of primary prevention, you know, the whole in terms of family violence, sexual violence, if young people are growing up with scripts that do normalise sexual aggression, and we know from the data that porn does reflect and reinforce a lot of the drivers of sexual violence, where when, you know, we're seeing a really strong need to integrate a lot of these messaging into the kind of mainstream family violence, sexual violence, primary prevention messaging and education. But you know, that's a big ask, but that's kind of the next phase. Most of our work is really driven by what young people are telling us that they're struggling with, they're seeing. Choking is a very big issue at the moment in New Zealand. We're seeing a much higher prevalence of presentations of choking during sex outside of the context of interpartner violence, if that makes sense. So hookups, and both young people themselves and services are really struggling with how do we respond to this. Most of our work in New Zealand has been in the non-fatal strangulation interpartner violence space. So we're wanting to do a little bit more work in that space as well.
Wow, amazing work. It links so strongly back, as you've said, to how do we understand how to have relationships that aren't aggressive or violent in the first place. And, you know, I sometimes passing parents as I do and not judging, because I've come through that trajectory of you learn how to parent and you then unlearn how to parent.
Yeah.
But often the communication style is aggressive. And there's lots of, you know, tears and anger, you know, shouting. They're opposite sides of the same coin. It's basically because we haven't been given the tools to understand how to breathe through triggers of fight or flight, to stay calm, to not go for the instinctive shouting or trying to get what you want by crying or shouting or being aggressive. And it's right back to that base level. How do I be a calm person? Yeah. You know, how do I raise my kids to be calm?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think there's work there too, yeah?
Yeah. Having kids myself, I suddenly dawned on me halfway through that actually the best way I can parent them is actually by sorting myself out. You know, the more whole we are as parents. I did quite a few wonderful mindful parenting course, and I'm like, really? It's actually all about me. You know, and the more that we can grow and learn and listen from and with our young people in our homes and in our work context, I think the greater the chance for kind of health and, young people becoming more resilient.
Yeah, communication, learning how to do it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's all the things that we're not seeing on in terms of the online sexual content that young people are engaging with. And we're seeing, you know, really big issues now too with the generation of sexual content. So young people that are getting OnlyFans, selling nudes, you know, camming, going online. And again, there's just no information for them. Mm. You know, some young people are coercively in situations where, you know, it might have happened in a coercive context, or they just really need the money and it's, you know, a kind of an easy side hustle. But they're not going into these experiences potentially equipped and with the knowledge that they need to do it safely. And consequently, we're seeing more online sexual harm in that space as well.
Guidelines are out, and, you know, working sex work is, you know, can be productive and financially rewarding and enjoyable. But a lot of the time it's anything but any of those things because people don't have guidelines or support. So I guess to anybody who's thinking about that space, it's look for the guidelines and supports that do exist, because there's some very good ones out there from within the sex work community by sex workers.
Absolutely. And I think New Zealand, in terms of, you know, New Zealand Prostitutes Collective, they've got, you know, incredible measures in terms of support. But what we're noticing is really we're talking about underage girls, 16, 15, that, you know, particularly with cost of living crisis during COVID, that were like, this is a really great side hustle that I can help mum and dad pay the rent, or I can, and we did a lot of, we actually created some content for young people thinking about creating sexual content. Nice. Yeah, and we interviewed lots of young content generators, and it was just really interesting. We asked them what they'd wish they'd told their future self, and so many just said we had no idea. They didn't think of themselves as getting into the sex industry. If that makes sense, that's different. They were just, they weren't sex workers. They weren't in the sex industry. They were just, you know, putting up contacts to get a little bit of money. Yeah. And often they said, you know, they do it to get some kind of sexual control or mastery, but they, many really felt that they lost it. They had no control over how the people that paid for the content engaged with them, and pushing them past boundaries, and then content that was lost or downloaded. So yeah, that's another whole area that's tricky, and I think we don't have measures in place for young people yet in terms of supporting them with the initial thinking around it.
That sounds like really good content. Where can somebody find it?
So that's also on our youth site called In The Know. There's a section saying, are you thinking of creating sexual content?
Right.
And then they go on there and it's got things to think about first. Am I more at risk? If I am going to do it, what are the safer platforms? What's a checklist I can go through?
Amazing.
So it's a really helpful, again, with young people saying, this is what we wished we'd known. And then we've offered up that information.
I think the biggest challenge with the site is the people understanding just the breadth of what you have available in there.
Yeah.
You know, and getting some, again, that good signposts out there, and hopefully, you know, lots of people like us picking up what you're doing and sharing it, because it's so valuable. Mm-hmm. And you're going into some tricky spaces.
Yeah. And Jane, you know, the book, just really want to endorse your book. It's just absolutely fantastic, because we have nothing in New Zealand like an actual book to give to parents that actually helps build critical thinking and information for parents, and then helps them in terms of how do I posture this conversation in a way that will open things up instead of close it down. So I think it's going to be a really fantastic tool for the parent community and wider, you know, in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. It's we did it for exactly those reasons and in that spirit. We've created it as a PDF download as well, because,
yes,
well, partly because it's ecologically a,
yes,
good thing,
yes,
but also because a lot of parents don't want to have this book sitting around, even though it's super cute and it's got the aliens,
yeah,
and it looks like ostensibly a kid's book. It's so cute. But
yeah,
for those that are feeling shy, the PDF download is, because you can just look at it on your laptop and read it privately, and then you'd probably go, oh, I could have bought the book.
Yeah. And I read it on my phone the first time. I downloaded the PDF. It's accessible. It's not, you know, it's totally, you know, reasonably priced. Anyone can afford it. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, well, maybe there's a collaboration and something around what we've been talking about. I'm not sure, but I do think the whole kind of understanding arousal and consent when you're aroused and how to navigate these things. It's all very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, but we shall see.
Yes.
Look, thank you, Nikki, so much for today. Is there anything we haven't talked about that's in your head that you'd like to kind of message out there?
No, probably the only thing I just was thinking now is another gap and something to be super mindful of is our rainbow young people.
Yes.
So rainbow young people are more likely to go to porn because of the massive learning gaps in our sex ed, and also because it's seen as kind of often as a safe place to explore and feel affirmed in their, you know, sexual or gender identity. And so what rainbow young people tell us is they often have really conflicting experiences where they might go to see same-sex representation, let's say, but most of the queer porn online, not all, but most, is actually made for the male gaze, so by heterosexuals. And the representation, particularly of bisexuals and trans, but also across the board, can be really fetishized and problematic. And gay porn in particular, I think they say gay and lesbian porn is the other way around, between 4 to 10 times more likely to show unconsensual aggressive sex. So it's a really aggressive genre, and so that can be a really disturbing experience for rainbow young people to go and then on one hand feel like, well, this is a safe place, but the representations, the aggressive nature can be really disturbing. And I think that can be quite confusing, and there can be a lot of judgment for adults. It could be a part of a rainbow young person's coming out when they see same-sex content online, and we don't yet have any resources for rainbow young people specifically around porn. But if any parents or people that work with youth are engaged with rainbow young people, which is probably all of us, then that's just something to be a little bit, I guess, mindful of and, you know, sensitive to.
Yeah, we touched on that in the book and felt very strongly about that. Yeah. I think maybe what this is calling out for me, it'd be good to get in touch with one of those who are doing really good representation in the space online, because there are some.
Yeah.
And to invite them to talk about what they're doing and why they've created it in the way they have.
Yeah.
Because, yes, this is such a gap in sexuality education.
Yeah.
It's not even touched on.
Yeah.
Very important as well. And we'll look to do some stuff that's specifically looking and signposting in that way, I think.
Great. Fantastic.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
Nikki Denham. Amazing woman, and you know, we're very lucky to have you on Aotearoa, but you're doing stuff I think that's a lot more global, so we have listeners all over the world. For any of you, go there, check it out. It's fantastic.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. You can find The Light Project at thelightproject.co.nz. And if you're a young person listening, check out intheknow.co.nz. Before we sign off, we wanted to remind you to check out our two books that we have available, How to Talk with Your Kids About Porn and The Organ Education Forgot. These are both available as a downloadable PDF or in print, and you can head on over to sexandspace.com to grab your copy. If you do, not only will you be educating yourself about a very important subject, but you'll also be supporting us and all the work that we do. If you'd like to support us in other ways, we'd love for you to buy some merch, which is also available on our website, and we have both mugs and t-shirts. As always, thank you so much for listening and being on this journey with us. Until next time, safe travels and see you on the next episode.